Welcome to the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast, where we explore family offices, real estate, and the art of preserving legacies and wealth. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and I'm going to be utilizing my experience of investing on behalf of a number of prominent families and working directly for a number of prominent families on their real estate portfolio. I'm going to tap into my decades worth of experience in real estate investing and relationships with some of the most prominent family office leaders in the industry, academics from universities around the world, and industry experts and leaders in the real estate space. So whether you're a family member, family office executive, family office, or real estate enthusiast, the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast will empower you with knowledge and influential voices. I'm DJ Van Kuren, and this is the Family Office Real Estate Institute podcast. In this episode of Family Office Real Estate Insights, we speak with Isaac Rothermel, principal of Storage Investment Capital, on self-storage and the current environment. Thank you for being a part of another Family Office Real Estate Insights. Today, we're going to talk self-storage, actually. And we have Isaac Rothermel with Storage Investment Capital. Isaac, how are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on, DJ.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm glad that you're on for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, self-storage was a huge thing that was going on. I mean, if you go back 10, 12, 13 years ago, and it was all the rage. And, you know, there's a couple of different reasons, right? One was that you had a lot of mom and pops, so it provided a great opportunity to do a roll up and into these and improve the efficiency and everything of those. And then it sort of died down from what we're hearing. So tell me a little bit, what's going on in the self-storage space right now?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an exciting space to be in. I've been in the industry for about 10 years. And I've really had the opportunity to watch it grow along with it kind of come out of backwater territory as a real estate asset class from 10 years ago to one of the most exciting opportunities out there today in real estate investing. Where would you like to start with a market perspective for investment deals?
Well, you know, you talk about that. It's a great opportunity today. Why do you say that? Right. I mean, sure. A lot of the big, you know, the main person at the ball has been multifamily for quite a number of years. Now, obviously, if you're in multifamily, you're probably going to need some storage at some point, or Absolutely. A lot of people are going to need that. Right. Yeah. So why self-storage still today, I guess, and what are you seeing in the market?
So I think self-storage is an even better opportunity today than it was a year or two ago, which is kind of a little bit of a contrarian take, but we're talking now in February 2023, interest rates have gone to levels higher than we had. We had a really nice run of really low interest rates for a couple of years, and they're returning to what some would call more normal levels. And as a result, my conversations with institutional LP partners, funds that place money into alternative assets, they have a renewed interest in self-storage. And the reason is simply because if you have a $750 million fund to place of equity, your preference would be to put it into student housing and multifamily instead of self-storage. Like, let's say you raise money for those three funds. You would rather put it in student housing and multifamily because you can get money out the door quicker. You can write bigger checks. Typical acquisition in multifamily side, let's just say $75 million would be a great class A multifamily asset. In comparison, self-storage, you really don't see a whole lot of transactions above the $20 to $30 million mark. That's pretty rarefied air. And in a lot of the class B assets and even class A assets in secondary markets are trading more in the, you know, $8 to $15 million range. So that makes it more challenging as someone who's writing checks trying to get money out the door. But the renewed interest in self-storage has come from the fact that there's yield. With higher interest rates, you know, the the other classes, multifamily and student housing, have proven to be very challenging to find yield in, and development transaction activity has sort of dropped off a cliff. In the self-storage world, to be honest with you, transaction activity has also dropped off a cliff because cap rates are still pretty much where they were pre-interest rate hikes. But development activity is robust. I wouldn't say it's, it's not higher than it's ever been. It's actually still somewhat fairly muted due to supply chain issues, and a lot of marginal development projects have gotten the axe. So it really kind of brings out the best of the crop, which is self-storage development projects that have a 8-9% plus yield on cost. Those still underwrite very favorably with our current debt environment.
So how are you, are you saying there's still a lot of mom and pops that are out there, individual owners of these locations?
There still are. My focus previously, even in 2021, I bought 7 self-storage properties from mom and pop owners. And those worked really well when you were buying at a 6% cap rate and you were leveraging with sub 3.5% debt from a local regional bank. Those don't work so well when the cap rate is still 6% or maybe 6.5%, maybe a modest concession, and your cost of debt right now is about 6.5%. So from there, I've shifted more back into the development side, which is more enjoyable for me. It's more complex than acquisitions, and you do have higher returns. It just takes more time, more effort, and more risk on the front end. You're still finding great opportunities.
But what about, how far out are these opportunities having to be if you're developing, right? It's got to be in the path of progress. It's got to be outside the cities. It's got to be, where I would imagine where that growth is happening with new homes and, new retail areas, et cetera. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I would agree with that. It sort of kind of depends on each individual submarket. I follow pretty actively some of the resources out there, like Green Street Advisors. We talked a little bit about Dr. Glenn Mueller. And self-storage is even more of a niche market, where a typical market area for a storage facility is probably a 3-mile radius. Mm-hmm. And they've figured that out over the years by taking the rent roll from individual properties, geolocating them and saying, oh, okay, most of our tenants are coming within 3 miles. So from there, it's really a case-by-case basis. My team and myself have developed a really thorough understanding of the mid-Atlantic self-storage market, where the opportunities are, where there's pockets of opportunity, where they're overbuilt, who the individual competitors are within a market area that are regionally dominant. I guess regionally dominant isn't quite the right word, but in individual metros, there will be 2 or 3 players who will be really dominant and try to buy everything in that market. Tough to compete with those people, but they're a great takeout option if you develop a facility in their market, because they'll be very aggressive in buying it.
Well, what about some of these publicly traded REITs? Are they still pretty active in acquiring existing product, or are they going out and are they buying, are they identifying and buying them direct from, these individual owners?
So a bit of both. In fact, right now, one of the main topics in the self-storage industry is that Public Storage has announced a hostile takeover bid of Life Storage. So that's two of the biggest owners of self-storage in the country. And it's obviously would be a landmark transaction. So far, Life Storage has not acquiesced to being purchased, but it's been made public. The offer's been made public. So there's anticipated to be pressure on the,
Is that because they were buying stock, I would imagine? So they kept acquiring Life Sciences stock, or now they're in control?
No, not even. So they were talking with the board of Life Storage confidentially, wrote them, I think it was 2 offers. And the board said, hey, we don't think this is in the best interest of our shareholders. We're going to decline. So Public Storage put out a press release and said, hey, we're making an offer publicly on Life Storage. And that puts the pressure on Life Storage to explain to their shareholders why that premium is not. I think it was a substantial premium. I think shares are trading at something like 95 and the offer was 120. I shouldn't be throwing numbers out there because I'm sure I'm wrong.
Substantial difference.
Very substantial premium.
What you're saying, and so by getting it out there publicly, I mean, shareholders are going to be like, what are you doing? I mean, we could have had a 30% bump in our share price, whatever the case was.
It's called a bear hug. And it actually, it remains to be seen whether that transaction is going to be consummated or not. Especially since Life Storage's stock has since come up a lot closer and that premium gap has closed. Mm-hmm. So to me, that would indicate that the public market anticipates that the transaction will be closed, mm-hmm. but it also gives less incentive for the board to sell. So we'll see.
That's a pretty big deal, right? Because now you've got a big company just getting bigger, et cetera. What type of competition are you seeing on existing properties right now? I know that you said that you guys are looking at development and to try to get a higher yield, but how much competition is on existing properties that you've seen in the market?
It's pretty intense. You're talking with people who own properties, mom and pop owners, people who have 1 to 5 facilities, they're getting calls weekly. And it's from a range of buyers. So you've got, on one end, you've got a local investor who's purchased, maybe has a portfolio of, let's just say 40 single family rentals. And now they're finally at the point where they could bite off a $5 million storage facility acquisition. And then you've got a lot of smaller to medium-sized real estate private equity groups that focus exclusively on storage, and they're constantly calling. They've got teams of people calling markets. And then, of course, you've got REITs. But the REITs are really selective, generally speaking. And the reason I say generally speaking is one trend I've seen over the course of my career has been that Wall Street analysts have really pushed REITs historically to improve their demographic profile year over year for their customer base. So every year, in addition to earnings, they also want to see higher household incomes in the market areas, greater density of population, et cetera, et cetera. But Extra Space Storage, which is one of the biggest owners of self-storage in the country, made waves last year when they purchased a large portfolio of storage properties that's located in secondary and tertiary markets. So they kind of are bucking the trend a little. Part of it was that this portfolio had developed a model of remote operation or, reducing payroll in their operations. And so Extra Space was interested in acquiring that operating model to augment their portfolio. But it remains to be seen whether that will bifurcate the institutional side of the industry, where essentially you're always going to have people who prefer to be in Class A markets, even at the premium or the lower returns. And then you're going to have people who are agnostic to that and say, for example, like Dollar General, look at where dollar stores are located in some of the smallest towns across the country, yet they still get very favorably treated from an investment perspective because a lot of people just buy into the concept and the business model. So the same thing is sort of happening in the storage side of things, where roll-ups are becoming more and more aggressive and have been over the last couple of years.
You know what percentage, and you may not on this, but what percentage of properties are still mom and pop? I mean, I would think that over the years, over the last 10, 12 years, that number has shrank, right? Because of roll-ups or because of other groups that are coming in and buying multiple properties. Is that market still readily available, or is it sort of, depends, I guess, or obviously it's going to be market driven, but.
Yeah, it kind of depends. And so takes kind of unpack that a little bit. On the one hand, something like 70% of self-storage properties in the country are still mom-and-pop owned. I don't know what the latest breakdown on that is, and it is changing by year. However, the caveat to that, so there are opportunities out there to buy mom-and-pop properties. However, the caveat to that is, I think most of the very desirable mom-and-pop properties have been purchased by real estate private equity groups or REITs. And so the really desirable ones are those located in primary or secondary markets that also have, call it, above 50,000 square feet. And what I mean by that is, if you have a facility that has under that 50,000 square feet, or, you know, let's just say you're looking at a property that's located in wealthy suburbs of Philadelphia, which is where I'm located. I'm in Westchester, Westchester County, Pennsylvania. And you've got a 30,000 square foot facility. So that's maybe 200, 250 units. You run into operational challenges on that property. It's not really large enough from an income perspective to support the fixed cost of third-party management and of an on-site manager. So you get into asking yourself, you know, it's like the multifamily world, where if you are an institutional owner of multifamily and your focus has been on 75 plus unit buildings, do you really want to buy a duplex, even if it's in your most desired market? Probably not. It's just a different logistical ballgame. And that's where you've gotten the single family rental, basically an entirely new industry, single family rentals and Invitation Homes, Blackstone, all playing in that space. Sort of the same thing is happening in the self-storage side, where it's almost a separate asset class in a way, just from an operational perspective, where because of the smaller size, you almost have to use more automation and lower quality of service. So that's where I think they're going to bifurcate to some extent. They're arguably competing for the same customers. I mean, self-storage has been called a commodity 1,000 times. But I do think a lot of customers are going to say, hey, I can rent at this, you know, row of garages, essentially. And maybe there's keypad entry gate, maybe there's not. Nobody's ever around. So there's going to be some issues with maintenance and things like that. Or I can rent at this multi-story shiny new facility that's got two dedicated staff members, and they're very responsive. They got a call center. They always pick up when I call. You know, the market's going to divide into those two buckets within each little submarket. And so there's opportunities in both.
Where would you say, you know, cash flow is king, right? Families love cash flow. What are some of the characteristics that, you know, if a family's looking at investing in the self-storage, what should they look for? And what are some of the red flags that, you know, they could be aware of as well?
So you want to talk about on a asset level basis?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So from an acquisition perspective, the biggest thing to look for is just the market supply and demand dynamic. It's really challenging to find a market that doesn't have barriers to entry, that has barriers to entry, true barriers to entry, because most markets, somebody can come in and build something. The barrier to entry from a capital perspective is relatively low to build a new storage facility. But you can look at a market as it is and say, where has it been trending over the last 12 months? How are rates trending in this market? And what's the square footage per capita of self-storage? Nationally speaking, the average square footage per capita is about 9 square feet. That's based on a database called StoreTrack, which is a publicly available online database you can subscribe to. And you can plug in any address and see within a 3-mile radius of my address, what's the supply per capita in that market area? And so you're looking at it, you're saying, okay, if it's 4 square feet per capita that's something that I'm really interested in because it's an undersupplied market. I'm probably going to continue to see increased revenue growth. In comparison, if it's substantially over that, that could be a concern. But in some parts of the country, notably the West, where recreational activities are really big, Colorado, Wyoming, et cetera, there's a lot more square footage per capita than the national average that's performing fairly well. The other factor to look at is new supply that's coming into the market. And generally, if I see one or two other new competitors coming into a market, that's a concern, but it's not a deal breaker. When you start to see more than that, 3, 4, 5 new competitors coming into a market area, and you know, it's relatively market area, that's something where I'll pull the plug on pursuing that project and just say, you know, I don't think this is going to play out well.
And what about some red flags? Let's say that there's a deal that's brought to a family and, you know, for self-storage. It sounds like competitors, you know, how many competitors are in that market? It's going to be a big thing, right? Yeah. Obviously the supply and demand is going to drive that as well. Is there anything else that you would say that, you know, you just don't like if outside of that competition coming in, you know, that you're like, I just need to pull back on this whole thing?
Yeah, I would avoid the smaller properties. Any, again,
how many units would you say when you're saying a small property?
Anything pretty much below 400 units, I would take a pass on. And there's a couple of reasons. Yeah.
Let's hear that, because there's a lot that, I mean, I think 200's a lot. I think 100 is a lot in many regards. And 400, I mean, that seems like a very sizable type of location.
Yeah. So just kind of do this back of the envelope math. 400 units would be, let's just say, would be 550,000 square feet. If you've got an average rental rate, let's say it's all drive up units, you've got an average rental rate of $14 a square foot, you've got gross potential income of $700,000 for property like that. You're going to lose 10% to vacancy, but you're going to gain another 4% to other forms of income. So you're sitting at about $655,000 in gross income on a property like that.
Yep.
Then you're going to lose about 30% of that to expenses, operating expenses, your real estate taxes, repairs, maintenance, insurance, et cetera, et cetera. So you're looking at about $460,000 in net operating income. Something like that might trade, let's just say, at a 6% cap rate. So you're looking at a $7.7 million facility when it's really, you know, maximized, it's humming. From there, three concerns really from a family office perspective. One would be anything below that starts to become challenging from an operational perspective to make sure that it is that you've spent that you're, you know, you're spending enough on third-party management, marketing, and payroll to stay competitive with new Class A competitors. Another concern would be from a capital placing perspective. One of the downsides to self-storage from an institutional real estate perspective is that it's more time intensive to place capital. You're not writing as big of checks. And if that's a concern for a family office where they're trying to get money out the door, then they're going to naturally orient to larger assets. If they're not focused on that, if they're focused on sheerly trying to maximize returns, they may go towards smaller assets, but you have to ask yourself at some point, is it juice worth the squeeze? In other words, if I have a highly paid team of professionals working for me on acquisitions, it's going to take them the same amount of work to take down a $15 million storage facility as it is to take down a $3 million storage facility, but I'm going to pay them the same amount. So that becomes a factor as well. And then on the third factor I would mention is on the takeout side of things, you know, if there's a desire to sell in the future.
Yeah. You want the bigger property because you'll have more options and more people that can actually take it out.
And more liquidity. They're more attractive to future buyers. Yep. So you're not going to struggle as much to find a buyer. That hasn't been an issue in the last few years, to be honest with you. Finding buyers for storage properties, from a broker perspective, if you get a listing in from 2019 to 2020, mid 2022, you'll sell it. No problem. Somebody's going to buy it. Somebody's going to pay top dollar for it. It's going to happen. That I don't think is safe to assume is the norm. That may be the case going forward. It's not the case right now, unfortunately, where...
Well, everything's been sort of backed off on, right? People have backed off. They've been waiting. A lot of families have been sitting on cash, you know, waiting to see some big change that may or may not happen, right? But that is, and what type of yields would you say that people would expect if they're looking at a portfolio today? I mean, today's February, end of February 23, right? So what type of yield would you say would be realistic?
So on an acquisition, if you're going out and buying existing properties, let's just say you're looking at class A to class B properties in secondary markets, storage properties, and you're looking at a five-year hold, you're probably looking at a high teens internal rate of return. A lot of that's going to depend upon where you're buying those properties at. So for example, there was a robust merchant builder market in the self storage industry where people were selling them at C of O, and investors were taking on the lease up risk. And those merchant build sales were selling for about 80 to 85% of the stabilized value. So if you weren't concerned at all about lease up, you were getting a little bit of a discount. But from there, it used to be low 20s. So it used to be a bit more attractive.
But I'm talking on cash on cash, not total, not IRR. I'm talking cash on cash.
So cash on cash,
it's got to be in single digits, right? It's probably six percent. Yeah, probably
maybe even a little higher than that. But yeah, it's not compelling. At least not to me. From the development side of things, what I'm seeing is, if you can wait three, four years to get through construction and lease up, you're then looking at mid to high teens cash on cash returns.
Which is pretty significant. I mean, that's a whole. So what I'm hearing from you then too is that, you know, self storage is which used to be the bell at the ball and sort of been pushed in the back is really still somebody you should dance with is really
absolutely.
What I'm hearing.
Absolutely.
That hard. So, all right. Well, listen, Isaac, Storage Investment Capital, Isaac Rothermel, thank you so much for being on the Family Office Real Estate Insights. You know, one of the things that we always focus on is trying to provide, you know, some of that information that usually isn't even thought about or to update on things. And this is great because, you know, even for myself, you know, it's sort of fallen off the radar, but it sounds like, you know, you really do need to take another look at it, especially if you can go through some of that development component and then look at that cash flow coming on the other side, right?
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure, DJ. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much. Once again, DJ, Family Office Real Estate Insights, be sure to catch us, you know, on our next episode. And once again, Isaac, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.